You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 27.
Well, yeah, the big one there is Fat Tails.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
All right, another week, another episode of The Local Maximum. Fun show today. First, I want to give a shout out to the Beyond Coding students of 2018. I just gave a workshop earlier this week, or like late last week. I gave a workshop on communication in the workplace to some students from City University of New York. About 30 students came into Foursquare headquarters, and we had that workshop. It was a lot of fun. I did it with Maryam Ali, who is on this show in episode 2, talking about internationalization. So long time collaboration between me and Maryam. And it was a lot of fun. I told them about this show. So I think that some of those students are listening. So welcome to the show. This is a good time to start in. So I had a great time. A lot of questions we're going to get to today. You know, is the software industry turning from big data into big algorithm? We'll discuss that and why. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the news on AI, machine learning, as well as social media bias and censorship. And then we're going to dive into the never-ending debate on Bayesian statistics. So for most of this, you can just listen. If you're a little rusty on what Bayes' rule is, you know, Bayesian inference, Bayesian versus frequentist, or what the general disagreement is there, you can try to listen. But for some of the background on that part, start at episode 0, The Great Beginning, or episode 21, Probability, Belief, and the Truth. I go into that a lot, and you'll have all the background. So this whole thing got kicked off recently at an academic conference called ICCS, the Conference on Complex Systems. This was held recently in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I kind of wish I went now because the next one is all the way in like Portugal or something like that. I just don't have time for all of these. Anyway, our friend Nassim Taleb said something about Bayes or Bayesian inference there. Sounded negative from the Twitter comments, but I can't be so sure since I wasn't actually there and I didn't listen to it. There's no video. Well, it turns out that Taleb actually speaks very highly of Bayes in general. When I spoke to Aaron, as you'll see, I couldn't find this tweet, but it reads as follows from @NNTaleb. Actually, I show an Antifragile, that's a recent book that I've read. The biggest intellectual productions came from country priests, for example, Bayes. So it doesn't sound so negative on Bayes. So what is this whole thing about? Aaron and I will start to get to the bottom of it. After all, there are whole books written on it, but we'll try to get to the gist of it here and kind of go over the real-world scenarios that anyone can understand where these instances of fat tails take place, and we'll define that because that's what we do on the program. All right, so without further ado, let's get started. Let's get Aaron on the program. Aaron, welcome back to The Local Maximum. It's been a while.
Yeah, it feels like it's been weeks, and I guess it has.
Yes, I had three interviews and a lone show when I was traveling in Ireland and from Belfast or outside of Belfast. So it's been, yeah, we've had a string of interviews. I have had success in, there are individuals out there who are interested in coming on the show. So that's a good thing.
Awesome. While you were in Northern Ireland, did you by any chance place a bid on the castle from Game of Thrones? I heard the castle they used for River Run is up for sale for a very reasonable price.
No, I didn't see the castle from River Run, but I did see the King's Road with the with the bent trees. I don't know how to describe it.
It's an arboreal arch. I'm sure that's not the proper term, but
yeah. You get there, and there's thousands of tourists taking pictures.
I just recently heard a thing about that. There's apparently a word in German, much like there are many words in German that do not have simple translations into English, but it's the word for going to a place of which you have seen, you know, thousands of pictures, like, for example, Old Faithful, and experiencing it there along with hundreds or thousands of other tourists, and how the experience of actually being there is less than the experience of viewing the, you know, the professional photographs and video of the place.
That's interesting. That's interesting. No, I think that being there in this case, and in some of like the natural, you know, the Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland, what is something that awesome. Like the pictures really can't capture. But it is kind of, you kind of feel like, you know, I want all these people to get out of the way.
Yeah. Who are these damn tourists ruining my tourism?
Seriously. They're not even Irish. all right. So we're going to start out today, before we get into the meat of it, which is the challenge to Bayesianism. Let's talk about some of the news stories that we're following. Tell me what you got, Aaron.
So I saw one come across my desk this past week about artificial intelligence in the military industrial sphere. And it turns out that DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is soliciting for research proposals in what they're calling a LWLL, or a Learning with Less Labels program. And I guess the main thrust is they want to find a way to reduce the amount of labeled data, your training set, to train up an AI system by six orders of magnitude, which is a huge deal. And I think one of the big motivators is that in their particular case, a lot of times they can't open source the labeling effort like you can in some commercial or industrial applications, because the training data they may be dealing with could in fact be, you know, classified or extremely limited in breadth, because we've only witnessed this type of event happening a handful of times, as opposed to show me 6 million pictures of stop signs to help train my automated car stop sign recognition algorithm.
Well, yeah, let me tell you why this particular story is interesting to me, because I remember, you know, back around the turn of the decade, maybe around when I joined Foursquare when I was in grad school, let's say 2010, the big rage was big data. You remember this, right? There's big data is a term that is still used, but maybe not as much anymore.
It's in way too many resumes, that's for sure.
Right. So it was just starting back then. And the idea was, you know, back then, and to some extent still true today, the mantra was, if you want smarter machines, if you want better machine learning algorithms, don't worry about the algorithm. Just get more data, because more data is going to mean smarter outcomes. You bang your head against the wall with an algorithm, maybe you'll get a slightly better outcome, but more data is way more is cheaper.
And this is definitely the tack that a Facebook or a Google would like to take, because they have access to way more data than almost anybody else.
Yeah, and you know, yes. So and my experience has been somewhat confirmed by this, but on the other hand, I've also noticed that big data comes with a lot of costs. First of all, if you have a lot of data, you have much larger memory requirements, and oftentimes the algorithms will take longer to run because you're running through a much bigger data set, and there's also you're kind of more limited in which algorithms you can run because they oftentimes have to be parallelized and all that. So it always seemed to me that the industry should come back around and work on the algorithm at some point when it becomes more cost effective. And seeing this headline makes me think, are we heading towards that point?
Yeah, there's definitely some drivers going there, or at least smart people are thinking about it, because
right. Also with the success of deep learning, you know, now being much more successful than it was, say, 8 years ago. 8 years ago, I feel like we all knew it was going to be successful, but it's like, okay, now algorithms can make a big difference and in a way that they couldn't before.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if any of our listeners are deep into that area of research and are interested in submitting proposals, looks like time is running out, because you need to have abstracts in by August 21st and full proposals by October 8th. But there's certainly government money to be spent on solving this problem.
Well, what I want to know from machine learning engineers, and if you want to weigh in at localmaxradio@gmail.com, is, you know, has big data run its course? Are we going, not that, you know, it's the end of big data, of course not, but like, is there, do you also sense a focus on algorithm, the focus going from more data to more algorithm now, or Is that the wrong direction? That's what I would like to know. Okay, moving on.
Well, I guess the only other thing I wanted to add to that is that even if we don't end up seeing the results of this publicly, because being a defense project, it may not be released in its entirety. Just seeing what groups and you know, companies and academic groups are involved in this research will be instructive to see who's kind of on the cutting edge of some of this type of work.
Well, yeah, if you see that university and someone, you know, a few months later comes out with a paper of like how to use less data, you know, you might think yeah, I didn't find anything as impactful. I just found a robot that can find Waldo.
Well, I don't know. I feel like that may have a more direct impact on me because it's likely to ruin my children's childhood by taking away their job. Whereas this DARPA stuff, we won't see for years.
Yeah, so this is ridiculous. This robot opens up Waldo, and then it searches the whole book, and it finds it. And then it drops a mechanical hand. I mean, it would be enough, really, if it just took a picture and then showed you on a screen where in the picture it was. But no, it's got to drop a mechanical hand to show you that it's... I don't know what it's trying to prove, but that works too. And then somebody noted in the comments, isn't the last page of that book like 1,000 Waldos and you have to figure out which one is the different one? So I don't know how well we'll do with it.
Well, and I guess the algorithm they talk about using there is specifically looking at faces. And as I recollect, once you've found Waldo on every page, you have to go back and you have to find, you've got to find the wizard and Wenda. And I don't remember his dog's name. And then other things like where are all those glasses and his staff, the wizard's staff and other items. Perhaps it would be trivial to train this robot to also find those things, but until they do, there's still a need for small children.
Yep. All right. Moving on, let's talk about this Twitter poll that I had. And I gave the results out last week, but the Twitter poll was on the subject of shadow banning by Twitter, which of course people raised eyebrows. They're like, how is Twitter promoting this when it's critical of Twitter? I don't know if it's that critical. Well, anyway, they did. So they let me. And I think a human actually did check it before it went through. So just to review, shadow banning is the idea that, well, shadow banning technically is the idea that Twitter can ban you without even knowing or can kind of mute you or silence you. But in this particular case, it was some Republican politicians who noticed that they were no longer coming up on autocomplete. So they were asking, were we shadow banned in the sense that we weren't coming up in the search terms anymore? And of course, this gives a wide range of opinions as to what's really going on. So 50% of the people think that these politicians just either imagined it because they think they're more important than they are, or they just made it up to get attention. That's 50%. But, you know, the other 50% think, no, it's real. And among them, it's 8% say it's a random glitch, which is actually what Twitter said, it seems like. 23% say it's left-leaning QA bias, and 19% said it was done deliberately by employees. So interesting results of our non-scientific poll that as a data scientist, I would never make decisions off of. But interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I think I fall in a somewhat similar camp to you on this in that I think is most likely perhaps unconscious or unintentional QA bias. However, I do think that there are some people who were complaining about this who fall into that first category that I believe there are people who are being their frequency of jumping results is being reduced by the algorithm. But then there are some people who they see that they're not popping up as much as they think they should, and that just because they have an overinflated sense of self. I think there is a correct answer among these to what is actually going on, but that does not address all of the cases where people are claiming that they've been shadow banned for the broader use of that term.
Right. So I want to write a little more about QA bias because I don't know if it's a term. I might have made it up. We'll see. But the idea is that yes, it was a mistake, but if the mistake were made by, it's kind of a mistake of neglect. So if it were done by, if that mistake had occurred, let's say on, Barack Obama, they would never have launched it. They would have caught it before it got out, just because, you know, a lot of them maybe follow Obama, and they wouldn't, you know, they would notice, the employees themselves notice, just like at Foursquare, if, you know, we're testing a change to our ratings algorithm and we notice that like our favorite restaurant is getting screwed, then we would look into it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like on maybe to use a in the news example today, Wikipedia, and perhaps it happens less now than it used to, but it used to be all the rage that people would go and deface is probably too strong a word, but they would embellish someone or something's Twitter page with, or I'm mixing my platforms here, someone or something's Wikipedia page with unverified facts, some of which were believable and some of which were quite outlandish. And unless it was a kind of high traffic page that had a dedicated set of moderators, it could go unnoticed for quite some time.
Oh yeah.
And so that's potentially what's going on here, is that there are changes being made, perhaps not maliciously, that are having an impact, and they're slipping through the cracks because it's not in a particular place that's being actively checked for.
Yeah. Yeah. And my point is though, that it could be, you know, because I think that the political leanings of Twitter employees are more democratic, a politician of maybe equal importance or equal footing would not be treated equally in the long run.
Yeah.
And so that kind of, I was asked about this a few times. I was asked about this on Run Your Mouth podcast a few weeks ago. And so I've been kind of adjusting my thinking on this. I did a little more thinking on this.
Well, and I know you mentioned last week that because of how Twitter polls work, you had to narrow it down to four options. But I think one of the big, if you were to add a fifth option, it would be to break that 19% deliberate by employees out into rogue employees versus kind of a top-down orchestrated effort.
Right, right. Or even like not rogue, but just like, you know, by a team. Yeah, so it's that and rogue. And it's also the first one is also needs to be broken up. That 50%, is it imagined or made up? Because those are actually two very different things. One is, I think I'm more important than I am, and so I'm going to complain. And the other is, hey, let's just say this, and that way it'll get people whipped up, and we'll get news about ourselves, and we'll get, we'll be able to fundraise off this. So definitely the extreme examples can be broken down a little bit. Okay, now I do want to follow one more news story that's related to Twitter in an interesting way. So the other day, almost all of the social networks and platforms out there banned popular conspiracy theorist Alex Jones from their platform. That includes YouTube and Facebook.
Is that his official banner now? Conspiracy theorist?
That's just what I said. Someone asked me the other day, oh, isn't he like the conspiracy theorist or racist? And I'm like, I think he's the only conspiracy theorist that doesn't go on with all the racist stuff, but he usually just shouts. And
yeah, I haven't listened to enough of his material to verify that there aren't racist conspiracies in there, but that's not the first thing that jumps to mind.
From what I've seen, there really aren't. But he does have a lot of,
he has no shortage of other kinds of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then sometimes it is very entertaining, and sometimes he's not wrong 100% of the time. Sometimes he can get through a show where you're like, okay, that's not.
So would you have him on your show if he were willing to be interviewed?
Of course. What are you talking about? I get like thousands. I don't think they would. They wouldn't ban my show just because he was on my show. I think
no, I don't think they would. But perhaps that could be one of your branding building blocks, is that along with Twitter, we are one place that will welcome Alex Jones.
Yeah, so we didn't get to that. So Twitter is the one that got embroiled in the shadow banning thing, and yet they're the only ones who are leaving Alex Jones up. And so I was questioning, well, are they the ones? Are they the ones who are going to go into being the more censorship-oriented you know, platforms. And from this one anecdote, it looks like, no, they're going to go more towards the free speech side. But again, it's just one example.
And this could change by the time this episode airs.
Oh, sure, sure. Which is very, very shortly. Yeah, well, I'm going to get, we'll see what kind of reaction we get for that discussion.
So have we officially issued a challenge for him to come on the show? Is that what just happened or no? Okay.
I'm still building up my audience here, and then I'll go after people with a larger audience.
Fair enough.
And also, it's not like he's looking for an audience now. Apparently, from what I've heard, this banning doesn't really work. It sort of backfires these days. I mean, he's got his own site. He's got its own servers. He could easily host himself on, and he can do live streams, and people will listen. And so there's kind of a Streisand effect where if you ban someone, then the news covers the fact that you ban them, and then it makes them more popular. So I'm a little bit... you know, even if you wanted to fight ideas like this or just fight, you know, against, you know, fake news like this, I don't think that this whole banning thing is necessarily the best way to go.
Yeah. And that absolutely makes sense. And I hadn't thought of it that way, but it kind of argues in the face of some of the theories people have been putting out in the last year or so about, you know, Twitter and Facebook needing to be regulated because they own the public square, and as well as this being a, you know, an orchestrated move by all of the tech companies together because they all banned him at the same time, that if it were really that, you know, kind of Illuminati-esque orchestrated maneuver, then not only would they have banned him, but there would have been a complete media blackout and they wouldn't even report on the banning. That's not what we've seen. We've seen the absolute opposite.
Yeah. It's kind of a clumsy, you know, it's like a clumsy thing where you sue someone. Wasn't it the Streisand effect, right? And then whatever you're trying to stop from getting out there gets out there even more than it otherwise would. I think, you know, most PR people these days, like particularly crisis people, realize this.
The good ones, I should hope.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get into the meat of this, because I've been preaching from the gospel of Bayesianism since the start of the show.
Back to Bayes.
And actually, I found out that I actually found an article that I wrote back in 2010 about machine superintelligence, which is interesting because I was talking about that with Christian Hubbs a little bit a few weeks ago. But I wrote that article in 2010 when I was first kind of grappling with these ideas. And even then I was talking about, you know, Bayesian statistics and Bayesian thinking as a good way to go. And I remember back in 2010, that was kind of, you know, some of the initial work I did and sort of reading up on all of this. Now, the interesting thing that happened this week was Nassim Taleb, sorry, I should pronounce his name correctly. I read a lot of his books. He's very active on Twitter, isn't he? He likes to wind people up, but in a good way. I mean, it gets his.
I was going to say he did not pull his punches when he thought somebody failed to understand his argument.
Yeah. Right. So now he's been sort of frustrated by kind of fighting against the Bayesianistas. He said that in his Twitter post. And so I kind of wanted to see, well, what's going on? Does he have, you know, is he turning into a frequentist? Is he sort of making arguments against, you know, Bayesian statistics? Is it a challenge, you know, to what I've been talking about on this show for many months? And so the idea for me, first of all, is, well, if I've been preaching something for many months and it's wrong, I want to know, or if there's a challenge to it and I need to address that, then I want to know. I am kind of open to being wrong on some of this stuff. But first, you know, before even going into that, I wanted to dive deep into, you know, what he was really saying, you know, because that was kind of a struggle. I kind of had to dive down, because what he was really saying was not so much a contradiction as to what I've been saying after all. So first of all, I want to point out that I looked into a lot of his past writings, and he's been just as skeptical of p-values and frequentist methods as we have. And not only that, he's done multiple studies and multiple Monte Carlo simulations on p-values and frequentist methods and shown how it produces phony results. So he's totally not in the frequentist camp, I would say. And he said good things about Bayes, the person, and his contribution in the book Anti-Fragile. I think he said, I don't know the exact quote, but he said something along the lines of my link isn't working right now, but he said something along the lines of some of the great breakthroughs in mathematics and science have come from people who, you know, were not considered the experts of the day, but were, you know, more not amateurs, but, you know, for example, Bayes was a reverend. So he made that example and he says, well, if he thinks that Bayes' contribution was one of the great contributions, then he can't really be that much of an anti-Bayesian, could he? So what's he on a rampage against now? I'll let his tweet sum it up. I'm just going to read his tweet completely. He says, the idea behind Bayesian approaches is that if two people have different priors, they will eventually converge to the same estimation via updating. A wrong prior is therefore okay. Under fat tails, if you have the wrong prior, you never get there. And then he cited his paper. And then he said, kabeech. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. Okay, so. All right, so that's sort of his post. Any questions about that before I continue on?
Well, yeah, the big one there is fat tails. Talk to me about that, because it seems like that's the crux of the argument here, is that there's a special case where this breaks down. Tell me more about what that actually means.
Right. So a fat tail is a situation where if an unlikely event occurs, then it occurs, you know, really, really severely. So an example he gives, and I'm kind of skipping around here, but an example that he gives is he was arguing against some data that Steven Pinker presented, I believe in his book called Enlightenment Now. Pinker presents like a series of arguments that says, you know, the world is getting better and better. And I read through a lot of those statistics and a lot of them are very convincing. You know, the economy is growing. Life expectancies are growing. You know, knowledge is growing. People are smarter, all that sort of stuff. But one of the statistics in there is that there's less death in wars. And so the idea is, well, okay, if you look at the last 10 years, 20 years, sure, there have been a lot of wars. I mean, we've been at war this whole time. But the number of deaths in those wars are less compared to previous wars in history. But we have this small risk of a global thermonuclear war, in which case we're going to have, you know, way more deaths than any time in history. So, and then also I would point out, like, what would that statistic look like in 1914 on the eve of World War One? It probably would look better than what they would actually experience over the next few years and really the next, you know, 30, 40 years. So that's sort of a fat tail. So one common misconception is that a fat tail means that the extreme events occur more often, but it's not that. It's that the extreme events are just really more extreme.
I'm trying to visualize it on a plot, and I'm,
it's difficult to do.
I'm picturing what you said it's not, as opposed to what you said it is. So I understand why people make that frequent misconception.
Yeah, I don't even want to start describing plots right now. I mean, that's a visual thing in a auditory format. So let's forget the plot. It's just, if an extreme event occurs, the extreme event might be less probable, but if it occurs, it's really extreme.
So really, you need to think not only what is the probability of an event occurring, but you need to weight that with the severity of the outcome.
Right, right. And if you have this fat tail situation, he says that the Bayesian priors don't don't converge. So let me back up a little bit and let me talk about how this fits in with some of the stuff I've been talking about on this show, because I presented the Bayesian point of view of the world as the one that makes the most sense in that episode. I think it was 21. And, you know, the Bayesian view of the world is one that's going to steer you in the right direction. So if you listen to episode 21, probability, belief, and the truth, I sort of talked about my epistemology, why I believe what I believe, and I kind of got to the bottom of why this is true. And Bayesian approaches are great for some of the hard questions. I didn't put it above kind of trial and error and also just, you know, making assumptions first, because I said you kind of have to do that before you get to the Bayesian approach. But I think that in most of the cases that you think about day to day, if two people have different beliefs and different priors, but they are both relatively open-minded, then the data will cause their beliefs to converge. So I want to talk now about the cases where, you know, Taleb's argument doesn't work. And I'm sure that he realizes that, but I think that being in, you know, being in finance and talking about some of the systems that he works with, he probably runs into people that ignore the fat tail time and time again. So, but let's talk about, there are times when you're not dealing with fat tails and then you don't have to worry about this, I think. So let me give an example, all right? So let's give like a toy example. Let's talk about the coin that could be fair or it could be double-sided on heads.
Which we've talked about this coin before.
Right. Now, let's say that you, Aaron, I give you the coin and you say, I'm not really, yeah, I'm going to be a Bayesian, but I'm going to be very lopsided. I think that there's only a 1 in a billion chance this is double-sided. I think it's, you know, billion minus 1 over billion chance that it's actually a fair coin. So your belief on the topic is like, it's damn near impossible that this coin is double-sided, right? 1 in a billion is a...
I'm basically only saying that so that I can defend myself from literally putting a probability at 100 or zero.
Right. Okay. So what happens then? Because you didn't set it at exactly zero, I can do a little bit of Bayesian math and I could determine how long it takes before you are convinced by updating your probabilities that the coin is more likely to be double-sided, because you start flipping it, right? And you get heads. And you keep saying, nah, it's a fair coin. It's just a coincidence. Heads, right? And so if you start at 1 in a billion, how long will it take before you think, okay, it's actually more likely that it's double-sided? And the answer to that, ready for it?
Hit me with it.
30 flips. After you flip that coin 30 times, you're going to think that the coin is double-sided. And then a few more flips after that, you're convinced that it's double-sided.
That's so pretty impressive, given the magnitude of my doubt going into it and the fact that 30 flips, yeah. I could do that in, you know, a couple minutes if I'm flipping slowly.
Yeah, because it's exponential, because each time you flip the coin, it's like, well, that's twice as likely to happen in the unfair coin as the fair coin. So your probability on that.
On the other hand, though, realizing if I were to literally experience even just 15 flips in a row where it comes back heads every time, I think I'm realizing that my prior going in was actually a lot less than 1 in a billion. Or to put it right, that number would require kind of an exaggeration of my doubt.
Right. So you realize that that's not really your prior.
Yeah.
Or you realize, well,
I was trying to express doubt and I overdid it picking that number.
Right. Yeah. And it's okay to go back on your prior and realize, well, I probably have a hyper prior where I could talk all about that. Let's not get it.
Save that for another
because
day.
Some people, because actually that is a good topic, because you know, your update, you kind of change your priors, and that is an argument against Bayesian statistics as well. People then go back and change their priors. Well, that's not, it's called a prior for a reason. How come you're doing that? You know, and that's and I think there are some justifications for that, but that's gonna be a whole other thing. So let's talk about the cases where the beliefs don't converge. Well, one obvious case that's not what Taleb is talking about is that when somebody refuses to entertain the possibility at all, like you said, if they put it at exactly zero. So that happens when one party hasn't thought of a hypothesis, and so they haven't really searched the space enough. Like, you haven't considered the fact that the coin might be double-sided, so it's like not on your radar, and you just sort of miss the fact that it could be double-sided even after flipping it lots of times. And you might say, well, I have to be an idiot to do that. But actually, our machines do that all the time, because if you don't program in that possibility, then we'll never know, right? And so also another case is that if your hypothesis space has enough variables, like an exponentially large number of terms, and you're like it's a billion dimensional space, and you don't have like a good prior on each one, then, you know, you're likely to overfit the machine learning model. Because
you can't isolate which variable is being influenced by the additional incoming data, or how to distribute that.
Yeah. And that's something that I'm struggling with now on the current product that I'm working on, which is trying to estimate the causality of an ad. Very valuable piece of information, very difficult to do. Actually, I'm going to talk. I have a guest. Maybe I could say it. It's Sharon Mojerad. She's the head of data science at McGraw-Hill. She lives up near you in Boston, and we're going to talk about causality in a few weeks. So that'll be really interesting. But neither of these cases that I talk about is, I think, what Taleb is talking about. So in the paper he linked, I read through it. He's talking about this special kind of problem that comes up over and over again in finance and insurance. And that's when these rare events can be so consequential. Just like you said, it's fat tails. So I talked about the war issue. And he's saying that the priors that are used don't always incorporate these crazy events. I'm not sure if he's saying it's impossible to properly incorporate a prior, or if, you know, the priors that most people incorporate don't take this into account. So that is kind of an open question that I would like to know about. If someone has more insight into this, localmaxradio@gmail.com. I do think, you know, when you're trying to figure out the relative possibility between a small number of, let's say, you know, finite number of like hypotheses, like let's say, you know, you're trying to solve a crime and you're like, there are six people who could have committed this murder. Or in the case of Twitter, there are four reasons why this Twitter ban, shadow ban controversy came up. And then we're trying to look at the data. I think in that case, you're pretty safe to use whatever prior, you know, your choice of prior at the beginning is not going to mess you up that much. But when you're dealing with these infinities, or when you're dealing with these kind of exponentially weird data sets where, an error could be off by orders of magnitude, then I think you have to look, because there could be a problem.
Yeah.
I think that's the way of thinking about it.
I didn't realize that this had Bayesian implications, but I'm going to rail on something that has bugged me at work recently. So I'm not in sales, but I work alongside a bunch of sales guys. And one of the things they have to do is,
I do too.
Is forecasting. And so they'll come up with a list of all the opportunities that we have, and they'll assign both dollar values and probabilities to those. And then you add that all up, and we can say, okay, for 2019, our expected value is X, because for example, we have this opportunity which we have a 50% chance of winning, and it's worth $5 million. So we're going to put that down as a $2.5 million expected outcome. And for first of all, if you have reasonable likelihoods assessed to those, then there's some utility to that. If you don't, then it becomes absolute garbage. But then as those percentages become lower and lower and closer to zero, so if you have a program that you think you have a 10% chance of winning, but it's $100 million program, so is that really, should that go into your forecast as a $10 million expected outcome? And if those numbers go even lower in terms of percentages, should those really even be on that sheet? Or what are those doing there? Because it's, In a way, it starts to throw everything else out of perspective, because you can have a very low probability but very high value event in there that skews your forecast. Or conversely, you could have a very high probability item in there, and if that doesn't pan out, that's going to have a huge impact potentially on hitting those expected
right. So you're
values.
You have a 10% chance of the 10 million, and that's worth a million. You have a 1% chance of the 100 million, and you have like 1 out of 1,000 chance of the $1 billion. When data is distributed like that, it can really screw you up if you don't think about it and you're just.
Yeah, where it works great is if you know, maybe there are, 10 programs that are each worth 10 million that you each have a 10% chance on. And so, okay, you know, if, when sure. we look at that, the odds are pretty good we're going to get one of them. But
the data, that's not power law distributed data. That's
right.
not fat tail. That's just normal. And so that's kind of the point that's the counterexample.
Yeah. So not only are there a lot of cases where people don't take them into account where maybe they should, but even when you do take them into account, unless you're very aware of how you're using the data and what's really behind it, it's easy for that to pollute your perception.
Yep. When you're talking about mean value with exponentially distributed data, then you get into trouble. That's, I think, the bottom line. Now, I do want to ask myself, do I incorporate this idea into my work at Foursquare or anything else that I've done? Because I thought about that, and I actually really do think that a lot of the stuff that I've done, I really haven't had to worry about the fat tail distribution. I'm open to the idea that I'm wrong, but I think that what I'm doing is justified for the types of things I've worked on. So for example, like in something like spam detection or sentiment analysis, there's not, a high probability of being, there's not a high cost to being wrong. Something is either spam or it's not. It's either positive or it's negative. They're binary classifications. And so there's no extreme events to screw it up. I do think that my current project, which with attribution, which again, as I tell this audience, is measuring the effectiveness of ads based on all the data we can find, that is a complex system. And so, I mean, I don't think that I need to worry about wildly successful or unsuccessful ad campaigns, because I don't think there's an ad campaign that causes everyone to see it, to go into a mesmerizing trance and then go visit the store. But even if there is, that's like...
You don't have Hypnotoad as a client?
Yeah, that like maxes... Yeah, right. That kind of maxes out where you can... How good you can be in the ad. But I think that I do need to worry about the effects that all these variables can have. And I'm not sure that there's a connection with this problem I face now with the types of things that Taleb is talking about with the fat tail. I'm not 100% sure whether there's a connection, but I think there might be. Maybe I'll end it on that.
Well, so that makes me think of a question, and maybe we can't answer this here and now, but it's something to think on, is how do you identify when you're dealing with those tails? What are the signs to look for? Because it's easy to go back and with with perfect knowledge, which is another thing we've talked about previously, but it's easy to go back after something's gone wrong and see, oh, this is where you screwed up, you didn't take X into account. Yeah. But it's a lot harder to see that when you're in the midst of it, that what you are overlooking could be critical.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would be, first of all, I mean, the idea is, I'm trying to think, because I think that most cases when it comes to like sort of real life situations are a lot of normalcy with sporadic extreme events. And so if you're dealing with something where an extreme event would matter to you, then yeah, you should think about it. I guess if I could think about, for example, insurance, right? Some insurance.
Yeah, I was going to say that brings us back to insurance.
Insurance premiums are capped, right? So an individual, let's say they're like, okay, this insurance is capped at like $1 million. We won't pay out anymore. So for that individual, there's a maximum. But then you might think, okay, what if you know, let's say I have property insurance and like the whole city is destroyed. Well, then I might need reinsurance. And then if the reinsurance fails, well, that means the whole planet is destroyed. That's, we shouldn't have to worry about that anyway. But like, I guess the question is, maybe you shouldn't ask, when is the case where I have to worry about this? Maybe you should flip that around and say, I always have to worry about this. When's the case where I can safely say I don't have to worry about this? And that's when maybe you're trying to decide between a few different choices, and you could be sure that there isn't an additional choice that you have to worry about. Yeah, that's the best answer I can give right now off the top of my head. I don't know. What do you think?
It sounds like it's getting dangerously into the whole predicting the future. And we've talked both in person and on the show before about some of the dangers of forecasting. Right. And not that fat tails only exist in forecasting, but it sounds like that's a big piece of it.
Forecasting would be
predicting the future and black swan events and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
forecasting, something to keep in the back of your head.
You know, economic news would be an obvious one.
I'm sure that there are some investors over at Tesla who are wishing that they had taken some of the fat tails of what will Elon do next into account a little bit more carefully.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he hits it big, it's really big. So,
but it also seems like he could implode almost at any moment.
Right, right. Well, so long as you're invested, I mean, a lot of times these investments, it's like, okay, I can lose everything, but I know how much I put into it, but my upside is unlimited. Mm. And so you want to be in those investments because you want to be in several of them because that's the idea behind a venture capital fund.
Right.
Your hits make up for your misses. Your misses are, you can only lose what you put into it, but your hits can go sky high. You know, hopefully you're finding the next, you know, huge home run, or even just, you know, a series of triples that'll give you great success in the long run. But as I've heard a VC speak, I think it was someone from FF Capital. Is that Fast Forward Capital or Fast Future Capital? I don't remember, but I'll have to remember. I think he said, you don't find out if you're a good VC until you're about ready to retire, you know, for like decades because of that randomness. So, all right. I think we're going to leave it there. Anything else that you've got for us, Aaron? Anything? Any last thoughts?
I think you've given me a lot to think about.
Yeah. All right.
I'm going to be trying to avoid these pitfalls.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on your day to day. Yeah. So, all right. If you have any comments on this one, I feel like we don't have all the answers today. We usually have all the answers, but hey, this is something we're learning along the rest of the audience. So please give us send us a comment at localmaxradio@gmail.com if you want to weigh in on this topic, and we'll read it on the show because this is a pretty fascinating one. This is one that we're going to cover a lot going forward. All right. Have a good week, Aaron. Maybe I'll see you next week.
Yeah. Let's update our priors and we'll talk next week.
That's the show. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. If you want to keep up, remember to follow The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account, @MaxClark. Have a great week.
Feel the power.
You're gonna see me shine someday. Amazing. Dream on Savannah. Dream on Savannah. A million trillion wishes and it won't make it all come true.
Yes, yes, I know I just did 3 interviews in a row with every person named Chris, but each Chris was very different and each Chris brought something to the program. So I'll let Chris Pye explain.